This is the beginning of lectures on the Book of Kings by Dr. Robert Vinoy of Biblical Theological Seminary. This will be a set of 17 lectures. This is the first lecture, Lecture 1 by Dr. Vinoy on the Book of Kings. I'm not going to do a whole lot more than read this tonight for this introductory section of the course. I want to do that with a handout because some of this is a bit complex, and I thought it would probably be easier for you to have it in written form than for you to try to take notes. Once we get into the Book of Kings itself and the content, I'm not going to do that, and you'll have to rely on your own note-taking. But for this introductory material I gave out tonight, we'll do the reading. First thing I want to do is discuss the name of the book. The title in Hebrew is Malachim, which is Kings. There's no evidence that the book was divided into two parts in the Hebrew until the edition of the Hebrew Bible that was published by Daniel Bomberg in 1516-1517 in Venice. The division of the book into two parts was introduced by the Septuagint. That's the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which combined Kings and Samuel into one great historical work titled 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th Book of Reigns, or Kings. Jerome altered this in the Vulgate to 1, 2, 3, 4 Kings. The division of the material into two parts has continued to the present in both Hebrew and modern language editions of the Bible. I think that's something worth knowing, particularly since you may see that reference to 1, 2, 3, or 4 Kings, which was the title that was used by Jerome in the Vulgate. In the Roman Catholic tradition, those titles are still used, so you may look up a commentary, or you may come across it in your reading sometime, and there's this reference to three kings, and wonder what in the world it is. Three kings would be the same as our first kings, because you see, in the Vulgate, Samuel was called first and second kings, and then what we call kings, first and second kings, was called third and fourth kings, because in the Vulgate, Samuel and Kings were sort of used as a unit, and so we have 1, 2, 3, and 4 kings. In Hebrew tradition, the books of Samuel are called Samuel and Kings, and it's called Kings, and that's what we follow. But originally, both those books were one unit in the Hebrew as well. There was one book of Samuel and one book of Kings. The division into two for each one was only done in the Septuagint, but then via the Septuagint, that came back to these later editions of the Hebrew text, so that our present Hebrew text, you do get two books of Kings and two books of Samuel. But that really was not the way it was done originally. It's clear, however, that the material of the two books constitutes an original unity. The division occurs at a rather arbitrary, although appropriate, place after the deaths of Ahab in 1 Kings chapter 22, verse 37, and Jehoshaphat in chapter 22, verse 30. Now Ahab was the king of the north and Jehoshaphat king of the south. You get the deaths of two major kings right in that last chapter of 1 Kings, so it's an appropriate place. But it lets the account of the reign of Ahaziah of Israel, that's chapter 22, verses 51 to 53, overlap the end of 1 Kings and the beginning of 2 Kings. The same is true with Elijah the prophet, whose life is narrated in 1 Kings, but whose translation to heaven is narrated in 2 Kings. So the division is somewhat arbitrary, but at a reasonably appropriate place. When taken as a unit, the book assumes a well-defined place in the Old Testament canon among the former prophets. The so-called former prophets, that's traditional Jewish nomenclature or designation for what we usually call the historical books. But the former prophets, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, together describe a history of pre-exilic Israel in Canaan. They begin after the death of Moses and end with the death of Nebuchadnezzar, who was succeeded by evil Merodach, who brought Israel's independence to an end. Kings describes the end of David's rule, the United Kingdom under Solomon, and the divided kingdom in its entirety. Okay, let's go to capital B in our outline, which we will call general content. Kings describes the last period of the history of pre-exilic Israel. It begins with the death of David and divides naturally into three major sections. The three major sections are 1 Kings chapters 1 to 11, which is a description of the rule of Solomon, under whom the kingdoms of Israel and Judah are united. Second, we have 1 Kings chapter 12 to 2 Kings chapter 17, which give the history of the divided kingdom until the downfall of Israel, that is, the northern kingdom, with the capture of Samaria by the Assyrians. Now that runs from 1 Kings chapter 12 through 2 Kings chapter 17, and this is the second major section of the books. The third is 2 Kings chapters 18 to 25, where you have the kingdom of Judah until the destruction of Jerusalem, with two supplements concerning Gedaliah, and that's 2 Kings chapter 25, verses 22 to 26, and the other person is Jehoiachin, which is 2 Kings chapter 22, verse 25, and then verses 27 to 30. Now, when I say the kingdom of Judah until the destruction of Jerusalem, that is the kingdom of Judah subsequent to the fall of Samaria in the north, on to the end. So that's from 721-722 BC down to 586 BC. So those are the three major sections. In the second section, the history of the two kingdoms is not given in separate narratives, but rather in a parallel fashion. Beginning with Jeroboam I, the technique utilized is to describe the reign and activities of a certain king, and then move to all the kings in the other kingdoms that were contemporary with it, and then work back and forth that way. The composition of the book is characterized by the setting of the description of each king in the framework of introductory and concluding formulae. The introductory formula usually contains the following six elements: age of succession, the length of reign, the place of rule, the mother's name, the assessment of the reign, and synchronization with other kings. That is, he began to reign in such and such a year of a king in some other kingdom. It synchronizes with that. The concluding formula usually contains a supplemental source, such as, the rest of the acts of so-and-so can be read in some other place. There's a death announcement, place of burial, and the name of the successor. An example of this framework is with Rehoboam in 1 Kings chapter 14, verse 21. He was 41 years old when he became king. He reigned 17 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Naamah, and she was an Ammonite. In chapter 14, verses 29 to 31, you read, and I'm quoting here, "As for the other events of Rehoboam's reign and all he did, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah? And Rehoboam rested with his fathers and was buried with them in the city of David. And Abijah his son succeeded him as king." End quote. So you see, those kinds of formulas at the beginning and at the end of the reign are pretty standard all the way through for each of the kings. They don't all contain all those elements, but usually they contain a pretty good number of them. Beginning with Abijah, another element is introduced into the introductory formula, namely that of synchronization with the rule of another kingdom. In 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 1, Abijah was the second king of the south, Rehoboam was the first, and then we have Abijah. And of Abijah it says, and I'm quoting, "In the 18th year of the reign of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, Abijah became king of Judah," end quote. So that's our first synchronization. Jeroboam was the first king in the north, and in the 18th year of his reign, Abijah begins to reign in the south. With Nadab of Israel in 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 28, and Asa of Judah, this 1 Kings chapter 16, verses 10 to 11, Elah's year of death are also synchronized. The most important element in the introductory and concluding formula, however, is the judgment or evaluation of the king according to the criterion as to whether or not he was faithful to the Lord and to the covenant, or fell into idolatry. Because the kings of Israel, which is the northern kingdom, all participated in the calf worship at Bethel and at Dan, they are all said to have, quote, walked in the way of Jeroboam, that would be Jeroboam the first, son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, end quote. And you find that starting in 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 34. Only with Joram, in that 2 Kings chapter 3, verse 2, and Hoshea, in 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 2, does the judgment include some commendation. So you see, with the northern kings, because right after the division of the kingdoms, Jeroboam set up those calves at Bethel and Dan, but those northern kings, all of them walked in the way of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, in their idolatrous sin. Assessment of the kings of Judah is somewhat more nuanced, but even when in general there are things in their activities that meet approval, there remains the fact that they have not removed the high places. Unqualified praises are only given to Hezekiah and to Josiah, both kings of the southern kingdom, and that's in 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 24, 2 Kings chapter 22, verse 3, and then chapter 23, verse 8. Five kings are given qualified approval: Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoash, Azariah, and Jotham. With those five kings of the south, it says that they were basically good kings, but they didn't remove the high places either. So there's that qualification. If you look up those texts, you can see that. The strongest disapproval is given to Ahab of the northern kingdom, that's 1 Kings chapter 16, verses 29 to 34, and Manasseh of the south, and that's in 2 Kings chapter 21. Those are the formulas that introduce and conclude the descriptions of the reigns of the various kings. It is generally accepted that these framework formulas are the works of the author themselves, even though they may have gleaned details of the information contained in them from the archives of the court. Difference of opinion exists, however, with respect to the time of their origin. Look at Übergeschichte in 1943, that's Traditional and Historical Studies by Martin Noth. The English translation is Deuteronomistic History, and that was translated into English in 1981. It's a very influential writing. Martin Noth suggests that these introductory and concluding formula are the latest material in the Book of Kings and constitute the final framework in which earlier material was set. On the other hand, you have Alfred Jepson in his book, 1956, called The Sources of the Books of Kings, and he adopts exactly the opposite standpoint of Noth. He says the framework material is the oldest material of the present Book of Kings, stemming from what he designates as, quote, the synchronistic chronicle, end quote, of Judah and Israel, including material from the annals of both kingdoms. He ascribes its composition to a priest living at about the end of the divided kingdom period. This provided the structure within which later editors inserted all sorts of material from other sources. Jepson regards the chronicle as the core of the present Book of Kings, containing in condensed form the history of both kingdoms till the time of Hezekiah. More detailed discussion of this would take us too far astray, so I don't want to get too much involved in that kind of discussion. When we look closer at the first major division, 1 Kings chapter 1 to 11, we find it divides into introductory material, chapters 1 and 2, and a conclusion in chapter 11. Between these two sections, chapters 3 to 10, center on what I call A, Solomon's Wisdom, chapters 3 and 4. B in the outline is building of the temple and the palace, and that's chapters 5 to 9. And then C is his prosperity and wealth, which is chapter 10. The reader notices immediately that the author has arranged this material to place the dark side of Solomon's life and activities in the final chapter. This arrangement is not strictly chronological, as can be seen especially by chapter 11, verses 14 and following, which for the most part refer to events much earlier than the preceding and following verses. Well, that's the structure of that first section, which is 1 Kings chapters 1 to 11, and that's about Solomon, and it continues to the end of the United Kingdom. The second major division is 1 Kings chapter 12 to 2 Kings chapter 17, and that contains a history of the divided kingdom period. This runs from the death of Solomon to the Assyrian exile of the northern kingdom in 722 BC. This is by far the largest of the three sections. The division of this material into, I should say, subsections is much more difficult than with the material relating to the reign of Solomon. In the first section, there is one king in about a 40-year period of history. The second major division, which is 1 Kings 12 to 2 Kings 17, as I've mentioned, that contains a history of the divided kingdom from the death of Solomon to the fall of Samaria. In the second section, there are numerous kings in the two kingdoms and more than 200 years of history. In only one instance is there simultaneous succession in the two kingdoms, mainly when Joram of Israel and Ahaziah of Judah were killed on the same day by Jehu, and that's in 2 Kings chapter 9, verses 21 to 28. The revolution of Jehu thus provides one major point of division for this section, 2 Kings chapter 9, and see the outline of sections 2 and 3 below. The question is how to divide the material further. Here's something quite different that calls for our attention. In a great deal of the remaining material, the prophets Elijah and Elisha assume a predominant place. These two men provide points of orientation for many of the narratives. The time of Elijah begins with 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 1, and the time of Elisha begins in 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 1. This, then, gives us three major points of orientation for the section 1 Kings chapter 12 to 2 Kings chapter 17. Number one is 1 Kings 17, that deals with Elijah. Number two is 2 Kings chapter 2, and that deals with Elisha. And then number three is 2 Kings chapter 9, and that deals with Jehu. Those are the three subdivisions of 1 Kings chapter 12 to 2 Kings chapter 17. Try to break that down. It's kind of hard because of all the synchronization, the rules of the kings in the north and kings in the south. But I think it's kind of three things you might say you can hang something on. 1 Kings chapter 17 is Elijah, 2 Kings chapter 2 is Elisha, and 2 Kings chapter 9 is Jehu. Jehu is a significant figure, so these divisions give you some sort of major dividing points. Now, with respect, prior to Elijah, an appropriate dividing point is the conclusion of 1 Kings chapter 14. Chapters 12 to 14 handle the history of Jeroboam the first and Rehoboam, the first two rulers of the divided kingdom. Chapters 15 and 16 handle both of their successors up to the time of the first appearance of Elijah. Chapters 17 and 19 have Elijah as their center of focus. Chapter 20, 1 Kings, the 2 Kings chapter 1, contains stories of Elijah interspersed with stories of Ahab's wars with the Syrians of Damascus. 2 Kings chapters 2 to 8 center around the ministry of Elisha, and 2 Kings, chapters 9 and 10, describe the revolution of Jehu, as I've mentioned before. 2 Kings, chapters 11 to 14, deal with the reigns of Joash and Amaziah of Judah and the contemporaneous kings of Israel. 2 Kings, chapters 15 to 17, deal with the last days of the northern kingdom with the contemporary kings of Judah. Then the final major section, 2 Kings, chapters 18 to 25, concerns the final days of the kingdom of Judah, beginning with the reign of Hezekiah and including the significant reigns of Manasseh and Josiah. Okay, so much on general content. That gives you some idea of the material that's covered in 1 and 2 Kings. Okay, capital C of the outline is authorship and sources. first authorship. The question of who wrote 1 and 2 Kings has long been a matter of discussion, with little solid evidence to justify basis for reaching a conclusion. In the Mishnah, Jeremiah is credited with the authorship of these books. Although this is not impossible, it seems highly unlikely. Few, if any, modern scholars accept this as a reliable tradition. Although Gleason Archer, in his introduction, regards it as possible that Jeremiah was the author of all but the last chapter, and this is interesting. Whoever wrote it had to have sourced the last events in Kings, which is the death of Jehoiachin, and that's in 2 Kings chapter 25, verses 27 to 30. While his death is not explicitly mentioned, the text speaks of provision at the king's table as long as he lived. How long he lived, we do not know. Recall that Jehoiachin was released from prison in the 37th year of the exile, and this would be evil Merodach, who succeeded Nebuchadnezzar as king of Babylon, who released him. This would be 652 BC, or about 25 years after the fall of Jerusalem. And again, this is 2 Kings chapter 25, verse 27. You look at 2 Kings chapter 25, verse 27, and you read, and I'm quoting here, "In the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiachin, king of Judah, in the year of evil Merodach, he became king of Babylon, and he released Jehoiachin from prison on the 27th day of the 12th month. He spoke kindly to him and gave him a seat of honor higher than those of the other kings who were with him in Babylon. So Jehoiachin put aside his prison clothes and for the rest of his life ate regularly at the king's table. Day by day, the king gave Jehoiachin a regular allowance as long as he lived." End quote. And again, that's the 37th year of the exile, or 652 B.C. We also know that Jeremiah was called to be a prophet in the 13th year of King Josiah. In Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 2, you read there, "The word of the Lord came to him in the 13th year of Josiah, son of Ammon, king of Judah." When he was still very young, Jeremiah says, "I'm only a child," and that's in chapter 1, verse 6 of Jeremiah. Josiah began to reign in 640 B.C. If we assume that Jeremiah was maybe 20 years old when he was called to be a prophet, then at the time of Jehoiachin's release, he would have been 85 years old. You see, 640 is the 13th year of Josiah. If Jeremiah was 20 years old, then his birth would have been around 647 B.C. And if you compare 647 with 562, which is the year of the expression of the release of Jehoiachin, that would have made Jeremiah 85 years old at the point in time that Jehoiachin is released. If you add 5 more years of time in which Jehoiachin enjoyed his new status, being released from prison, we come to about 90 years of age for Jeremiah. While it's not impossible for Jeremiah to have lived this long to have written in 1 and 2 Kings, it does not seem likely for various reasons. First, E.J. Young points out in his introduction on page 188 that it seems likely that the account of the deportation and imprisonment of Jehoiachin was written in Babylon, but Jeremiah was taken to Egypt. Remember, after Jerusalem was taken, Jeremiah went to Egypt, and that's in Jeremiah chapter 43, verses 1 to 8. Second, in the last chapter of Jeremiah, chapter 52, this is very familiar to 2 Kings chapter 24, verses 18 to 25 and verse 30, but in Jeremiah chapter 51, verse 64, we read the words of Jeremiah end here. See, the last phrase of that chapter is "the words of Jeremiah end here," and then in chapter 52, you have a description of the fall of Jerusalem, which is very similar to what you have in the book of Kings. It appears that Jeremiah chapter 52 and 2 Kings chapter 24, and this is verses 18 to 25, and add in verse 30 as well, are derived from a common source that was not written by Jeremiah. There are minor verbal differences in the two accounts. Archer, who argues for Jeremiah's authorship, finds evidence for this in the fact that Jeremiah is not mentioned in 1 and 2 Kings. I guess he feels that Jeremiah would not have drawn attention to himself as the author, and therefore excludes any reference to himself, and that's an indication that he's the writer. This is an argument from silence, however, and is hardly compelling. The names of other prophets are also unmentioned. For example, Ezekiel, who was taken captive at the same time as Jehoiachin, is not mentioned. Jonah is mentioned in 2 Kings chapter 14. So some prophets are mentioned, but some are not. So I don't think you can draw much of a conclusion from the fact that Jeremiah is not mentioned as evidence that he is the author of Kings. So there's little hard evidence to establish Jeremiah's authorship of Kings. Among the literary critical school, there are those who have attempted to find the JDP sources extended on through Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and on into Kings. This has little following today, although Otto Eisfeld is an advocate of this view. This pre-Deuteronomistic material is then regarded as restructured and added to it by the Deuteronomistic editor or editors. The generally accepted critical idea is that there were two Deuteronomistic editions of Kings, one at about 600 BC, variously viewed as either shortly before or shortly after the death of Josiah, and then a revision with additions composed during the exile by 550 BC. This view requires extensive separation of original material from later interpretations, the details of which we cannot discuss here. As R.K. Harrison in Old Testament Introduction notes, he says the extent of the disagreement among those who accept the postulate of two Deuteronomistic editors is an indication of the basic weakness of the theory, and that's page 731 of his book. That issue has created just an enormous argument in the literature. Analyzing Kings, critics try to separate the original material and the later Deuteronomistic editing of the material. What is the more original material, and supposing there were two editions of this Deuteronomistic editing of the material and separating out the first from the second, it is really enormously complex material with a lot of disagreement. Everybody writing a book on that has different conclusion as far as how each passage is identified as what. It seems to me the author was someone in the line of the prophets. We don't know the author. The author is anonymous, but that's exactly what the prophets did. Kings is really a prophetic interpretation of history, and it seems like there must have been a prophet to pull this material together, but we just don't know who did it. The most dominant current idea with respect to authorship is Martin Noth's Deuteronomistic History Theory. See Martin Noth in his work Deuteronomistic History, published in English in 1981. We've discussed this before. According to Noth, a Deuteronomistic historic collective of ancients sifted the material for Kings and arranged it according to the principles of a Deuteronomistic theology of history. In this view, there was just one author for the entire corpus of material from Deuteronomy to 2 Kings. See, that really builds on the old Wellhausen view that the Book of the Covenant found in the temple at the time of Josiah was the Book of Deuteronomy. It had largely been ignored or lost. But not just that, it had been composed in the time of Josiah in an attempt to centralize worship in Jerusalem. The Book of Deuteronomy wasn't really around until the time of Josiah, according to this theory. But in any case, the Deuteronomistic historian added, in Noth's view, Deuteronomy chapters 1-4 as an introduction to his entire history, as well as Deuteronomy chapters 29 and 30. This person, the Deuteronomistic author, also compiled Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings as a theological presentation governed by the ideals and materials of Deuteronomy. This means that for Noth, 1 and 2 Kings was the work of a single author living in the exilic period. This author utilized various traditions and sources at his disposal to present the history of the monarchical period in Israel's existence as a nation as in tune with the Deuteronomistic perspective. In Noth's view, the framework in 1 and 2 Kings was created at the same time as the narrative material was molded into a unified composition. The author of the framework is the same as the author-editor of the narrative material. The work is a carefully planned treatise from the hand of a single author. Now, with respect to that, there's no problem with that. The other aspects of this theory have a lot of problems with it, but at least he sees a unified plan to the book, and he sees the influence of Deuteronomy in the book. There's a general agreement among the critical scholars today that 1 and 2 Kings is a history work governed by a Deuteronomistic viewpoint, by means of which the actions of the various kings of Israel are assessed, that is, assessed according to Deuteronomistic theology. While we may agree with this characterization of the book, it is well to keep a distinction in mind when using the term Deuteronomistic or Deuteronomic. In critical circles, the term usually rests on the presupposition that the book of Deuteronomy was composed shortly before the Reformation during the reign of King Josiah, and that this book provided the basis for this Reformation. The ideas of Deuteronomy are considered new and revolutionary, ideas arising in Israel fairly late in the monarchical period. The time of Josiah is just shortly before the end of the Southern Kingdom in 586 BC. There are, of course, serious objections to such a viewpoint. Emphasis in Deuteronomy on obedience to the law with the resulting blessing or curse is not just Deuteronomistic. It is covenantal, and is found in Exodus and Leviticus just as much as in Deuteronomy. Of course, what these critical scholars would say is that Exodus and Leviticus were, for the most part, later or pre-exilic material. It gets very complicated if you don't accept the biblical material as it is presented to us, with Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy originally coming from the time of Moses. The critical school, however, also makes much of what is viewed as a Deuteronomistic requirement of centralization of worship in Jerusalem, which necessitated the destruction of the high places throughout the land. This centralization requirement is supposedly taught in Deuteronomy chapter 12 and came into existence around 621 BC at the same time as supposedly the book of Deuteronomy was written in the time of Josiah. Now, that's a subject of discussion in its own right, whether Deuteronomy chapter 12 really requires a single sanctuary, that the only legitimate worship being permitted is at that one place in Jerusalem, at that one altar, all other altars being per se illegitimate. I don't think that's what Deuteronomy says, but that's the view of this approach that we have been discussing. In a critical view, this requirement then became a primary standard by which each king was judged. It must be noted, however, that it's not so clear that Deuteronomy chapter 12 requires centralization of worship. And in addition, when one accepts the general critical position on Deuteronomy and the date of its authorship, then one must view the evaluation of the earlier kings by this late standard as an artificial and distorted way of assessing their reigns. In other words, if Deuteronomy wasn't around till the time of Josiah, how could you assess the reign of, say, Rehoboam, first king of the southern kingdom, on the basis of Deuteronomy, if Deuteronomy doesn't exist in 931 BC when Rehoboam reigns? How could you assess Rehoboam's reign on the basis of Deuteronomy if Deuteronomy didn't exist until 300 years later in 621 BC? So, if you accept this critical position in the date 621 for Deuteronomy, then you must view the evaluation of the earlier kings by this late standard as an artificial and distorted way of assessing their kingships. A Deuteronomistic history writer must be viewed as more interested in his theology than in the facts of history. So, his writing becomes a theological history in the sense that his theology requires distortions of what actually happened. For example, Wellhausen made the following statement concerning the division of the kingdom and the establishment of worship centers at Bethel and Dan by Jeroboam I. And I'm quoting him here. As for their departure from the Mosaic cultus observed at Jerusalem, on the one hand, it was first alleged against them as a sin only by the later Jews. At the time, religion put no obstacle in the way of their separation. On the contrary, it actually suggests it promoted it. The Jerusalem cultus had not yet come to be regarded as the alone legitimate one. That instituted by Jeroboam at Bethel and Dan was recognized as equally right. Images of the deities were exhibited in all three places, and indeed at every place where the house of God was found. End quote. In other words, the actual situation in Jeroboam's time is alleged to have differed greatly from the presentation that we find in Deuteronomistic history. This forces Wellhausen to question the actuality of the whole story of the man of God of Judah who spoke against Jeroboam's altar that we find in 1 Kings 13. See, that man of God out of Judah that we read about in 1 Kings 13 goes off and condemns that altar at Bethel. Well, if in that early time there wasn't any idea of centralization of worship, which Wellhausen felt was required by a Deuteronomy that didn't exist at that time, why would the man of God go out of Judah and then go up and condemn worship at the altar in Bethel? Well, Wellhausen simply thinks he didn't. The story never happened. He thinks it's a construction from a later time trying to read back to the theology of Deuteronomy over time. This story is developed to suggest that this idea was an ancient idea when in fact it was not. So this forces Wellhausen to question the actuality of that whole story, which he does. He doesn't think it ever happened, period. Elsewhere, Wellhausen can say of the Deuteronomistic revision of 1 and 2 Kings, and I quote him here, "This revision is, as we expect to find, alien to the materials that the work is founded on, so that it does violence to them." End quote. He speaks of the facts of the book not only being judged, but also framed in accordance with the Josianic book of Deuteronomy. This was all done in order to give a theological explanation to people in exile for their condition, according to Wellhausen. But this means that wherever Deuteronomy and its viewpoints are found in the text prior to the time of Josiah, they were regarded as secondary insertions and distortions of what actually happened. So much for authorship for the moment. We'll come back to that later. But just to summarize that if Wellhausen's view is true, then 1 and 2 Kings do not give real history. Because 1 and 2 Kings spans such a long period of time, it is natural to expect that the author utilized various sources of historical material which were at his disposal. It seems to have been a history of the kings of Israel and the history of the kings of Judah, which is frequently referred to as the Book of the Annals of the Kings of Israel, or the Book of the Annals of the Kings of Judah. Look at 1 Kings chapter 14, verse 19. You get this reference that is used quite regularly. 1 Kings 14:19 says, after discussing Jeroboam, quote, "The other events of Jeroboam's reign, his wars and how he ruled, are written in the books of the annals of the kings of Israel." End quote. So the writer refers his readers to another source, which presumably was something accessible if someone wanted to get more information. 1 Kings 15:23, that is chapter 15, verse 23, gives you the other source. Quote, "As for the other events of Asa's reign, all his achievements, all he did and the cities he built, are written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah." End quote. There are 33 references to those two sources through the books of 1 and 2 Kings. So there are quite a few references then. So when you get to the book of the annals of the kings of Israel, that's the north. It can't refer to Chronicles. It seems like there are two sources, probably court records or something like that, that had been kept in some way and were accessible and known. There are a number of sources mentioned in Chronicles too, and it may be that the writer of Chronicles had some access to 1 and 2 Kings. That's possible because Chronicles is written later. The question, of course, rises concerning the nature of these two sources, that is, the annals of the kings of Israel and the annals of the kings of Judah. It is to be noted that reference to them begins only after the division of the kingdom, in that presumably they were sources which began at that point in time. It is not so clear, however, whether they were the official court annals or some sort of history written by someone who had access to the official court annals. Those in favor of the last view say that the matter of reference to them presupposes that they were accessible to everyone who might desire to consult them. This could not be said of official court annals. Yet, who knows how accessible such material might have been? It might also be questioned whether official court annals were to have contained the record of a plot to gain the kingship. For example, in 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 20, it says, quote, "As for the other events of Zimri's reign and the rebellion he carried out, are they not written in the books of the kings of Israel?" End quote. We don't really know much about what these sources were, but they are repeatedly referred to. For the history of Solomon, another source is used, referred to in 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 41, as, quote, "the book of the annals of Solomon," end quote. Here it is even more difficult to determine the character of who is writing. Some say it was purely a pragmatic, propagandistic sort of work. Others say it was a history, which contained exclusively political account of Solomon's reign. Others say it was broader in content than simply political material. There are lengthy discussions on this issue, but no grounds on which to draw a solid conclusion. But there's another source, the Book of the Annals of Solomon, that is referred to there in 1 Kings chapter 11. It is highly probable that the author of Kings had access to other sources that he does not specifically mention. This is especially the case for material in Kings that one would not expect to be derived from court annals, as, for example, the extensive narratives concerning the prophets Elijah and Elisha. It is not possible to determine if material of this sort is derived from some single source or from various separate prophetic accounts. In general, most scholars are inclined to the latter position. H.H. Rowley, famous scholar in Old Testament studies, labels these sources as prophetic biographies. He says how many of these were used, we cannot say. But in addition to the cycles of stories dealing with Elijah and Elisha and Isaiah, we find the story of Micaiah in 1 Kings chapter 22. It seems to me, besides the official court annals, the writer must have had access to some sort of material that dealt with Elijah and these prophets, and utilized all that material together in writing this book. But we don't have a lot of hard evidences to know precisely what these sources were or how many of them there were. Third, let's look at date for composition. 1 and 2 Kings must have been written after the announcement of the release of Jehoiachin from prison in Babylon and, by implication, his position of honor there in Babylon until his death. We do not know the date of Jehoiachin's death, but in any case, it was subsequent to the death of Nebuchadnezzar and the succession of evil Merodach coming to the throne, which is in 562 BC. So sometime, probably not long after 562, is the earliest the book could have been written because it includes this material. There are considerations, however, that have caused some to regard the final material in the book as added to an earlier original composition. In a number of instances, certain things from the pre-exilic period are said to continue in existence, quote, to this day, end quote. This is thought by some to indicate a composition in pre-exilic time. For example, in 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 8, we read about the poles that were used to carry the ark. These poles were so long that their ends could be seen from the holy place in front of the inner sanctuary, but not outside the holy place, and, quote, "they are still there today," end quote. See, that's said in 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 8. After the destruction of the temple and the loss of the ark, this was no longer the case. One obviously would not be able to see the poles. We read in 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 20 to 21, that Solomon conscripted people left from the Hittites Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites for a slave force, quote, as it is to this day, end quote. This, by nature of the case, applied as long as the kingdom of Judah continued to exist. The statements in 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 19, that Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David, quote, to this day, end quote, and then in 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 22, that Edom has been in rebellion against Judah, quote, to this day, end quote, presuppose the continued existence of the kingdom of Judah. Other similar references are less problematic, but nevertheless, taken together, they seem to fit better with a writer who lived in Palestine in pre-exilic time than one in Babylon in post-exilic time. If one accepts the possibility of pre-exilic work added to in post-exilic time, then the question is, when did the pre-exilic work come into existence? When one notices that reference to the source called the Annals of the Kings of Judah is cited with reference to the rule of King Jehoiakim, but is absent with respect to his successors, Jehoiachin and Zedekiah, then there is some reason to assume that the first composition occurred in the period between the death of Jehoiakim and the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC. In other words, in the very last years before the captivity, this is when this would have been written. The conclusion is then described as one living in exilic times. While this is possible, the viewpoint on date and authorship being pre-exilic, it rests largely on the expression, to this day, statements. An alternative is to take these statements, to this day, as those of the original source rather than the final compilation of Kings. Note 2 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 9, compared with 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 8. 2 Chronicles 5, 9 says, quote, these poles were so long, that's the poles that carry the ark, that their ends extending from the ark could be seen from in front of the inner sanctuary, but not from outside the holy place, and they are still there today, end quote. 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 8. These poles were so long that their ends could be seen from the holy place in front of the inner sanctuary, but not from outside the holy place, and they are still there today, end quote. Now, note 2 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 9, compared to 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 8. Chronicles was certainly post-exilic, yet the wording is the same. The most probable explanation is that the chronicler, that is the one who wrote Chronicles, simply quoted his source, namely 1 Kings. Why could not the compiler author of Kings have done the same with his own sources? This would alleviate the problem of positing a redaction of an earlier book of Kings by an exilic editor and retain the unity of the composition by a single author living in exile utilizing the various sources that were at his disposal. In other words, the to this day expression could be the expression of the source that the writer simply quotes, not that he, the chronicler, later in post-exilic times, is using the phrase to this day, meaning that it extended into exilic times. If you don't say that, you almost have to say that part of the book was written before the exile. With this last section dealing with Jehoiachin's imprisonment and release, that was added later by an editor. But a way around that is this suggestion, the terminus ante quem, before which is the end of the Babylonian captivity, 539 BC. There's no mention of this end and no hint that it's imminent. 539 BC is important because Cyrus released the captives to go back to Jerusalem in 539 after he defeated the Babylonians. The book, then, must have reached its final form prior to this time of 539. Although this is an argument from silence, which often is not convincing, in this case, the return from captivity is of such enormous significance that the author who related it would hardly have been able to be silent about its end, that is, the end of the captivity, if it had already materialized. It seems quite certain that the end of captivity was not yet in sight, and there's no hint of this. I think I'll stop at this point. I have another handout to go a bit further with some of this introductory material that we'll look at probably the first hour next week, and then we'll get into the Book of Kings itself. That's the end of Lecture 1 by Robert Vannoy on the Book of Kings.